Hello and welcome to Essential Dissent, coming to you from the last days of the U.S. Empire. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer of the series. This episode is To Kill a People, the opening keynote speech given by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Chris Hedges on November 1, 2024 at the University of California at Santa Barbara. The event, organized by Green Party vice presidential nominee Butch Ware, was a conference titled End of Empire. Chris Hedges can be found on Substack and on the Chris Hedges YouTube channel. Please note that the views expressed on Essential Dissent are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect my own views or those of this radio station.
Extermination works at first. This is the terrible lesson of history. If Israel is not stopped, and no outside power appears willing to halt the genocide in Gaza or the destruction of Lebanon, Israel will achieve its goals of depopulating and annexing northern Gaza. It will turn Gaza, southern Gaza, into a charnel house where Palestinians are burned alive, decimated by bombs, and die from starvation and infectious diseases until they are driven out. It will achieve its goal of destroying Lebanon. 2,400 people have been killed and over 1.2 million Lebanese have been displaced in an attempt to turn it into a failed state. And it is already turning its genocidal fury on the West Bank. It may realize its long-cherished dream of forcing the United States into a war with Iran. Israeli leaders are publicly salivating over the proposal to assassinate the Iranian leader and carry out airstrikes on Iran's nuclear installations and oil facilities. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his cabinet, like those driving Middle East policy in the White House, Anthony Blinken, raised in a staunch Zionist household, Brett McGurk, Amos Hochstein, who was born in Israel and served in the Israeli military, and Jake Sullivan, are true believers in the doctrine that violence can mold the world to fit their demented vision. That this doctrine has been a spectacular failure in Israel's occupied territories and did not work in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and Libya, and a generation earlier in Vietnam, does not deter them. This time, they assure us it will succeed. In the short term, they are right. And this is not good news for the Palestinians or the Lebanese. The US and Israel will continue to use their arsenal of industrial weapons to kill huge numbers of people and turn cities into rubble. But in the long term, this indiscriminate violence sows dragon's teeth. It creates adversaries that sometimes a generation later outdo in savagery. We call it terrorism. What was done to those slain in the previous generation? Hate and a lust for vengeance, as I learned covering the war in the former Yugoslavia, are passed down like a poisonous elixir from one generation to the next. Our disastrous interventions in Afghanistan, Syria, Iraq, Libya, and Yemen, along with Israel's invasion of Lebanon in 1982, which created Hezbollah, should have taught us this. But this is a lesson that is never learned. How, for example, could the Bush administration imagine it would be greeted as liberators in Iraq when the U.S. had spent over a decade imposing sanctions that resulted in severe shortages of food and medicine, causing the deaths of at least 1 million Iraqis, including 500,000 children? Israel's occupation of Palestine and the saturation bombing of Lebanon in 1982 were the catalyst for Osama bin Laden's attack on the Twin Towers in New York City in 2001, along with U.S. support for attacks on Muslims in Somalia, Chechnya, Kashmir, and the south of the Philippines, as well as U.S. military assistance to Israel and the sanctions on Iraq. I see nothing to halt Israel, especially since the Israel lobby has bought and paid for Congress and the two ruling parties, as well as cowing the media and universities. There's money to be made in war, a lot of it. And the influence of the war industry, buttressed by the hundreds of millions of dollars spent on political campaigns by the Zionists, is a formidable barrier to peace, not to mention sanity. Israel has been poisoned by the psychosis of permanent war. It has been morally bankrupted by the sanctification of victimhood, which it uses to justify an occupation that is even more savage than that of apartheid South Africa. Its democracy, which was always exclusively for Jews, has been hijacked by extremists who are pushing the country towards fascism. Human rights campaigners, intellectuals, journalists, Israeli and Palestinian, are subject to constant state surveillance, arbitrary arrests, and government-run smear campaigns. Israel's educational system, starting in primary school, is an indoctrination machine for the military, and the greed and corruption of its venal political and economic elite have created vast income disparities that mirror the decay within America's democracy, along with a culture of anti-Arab and anti-Black racism. By the time Israel achieves its decimation of Gaza, and Israel is talking about months more of warfare, its facade of civility, its supposed vaunted respect for the rule of law and democracy, its mythical story of the courageous Israeli military and miraculous birth of the Jewish nation, which it successfully sold to its Western audiences, will lie in ash heaps. Israel's social capital will be spent. It will be revealed as the ugly, repressive, hate-filled apartheid regime it always has been, alienating younger generations of American Jews. Its patron, the United States, as new generations come into power, will distance itself from Israel. Its popular support will come from reactionary Zionists and America's Christianized fascists who see Israel's domination of ancient biblical land as a harbinger of the second coming and its subjugation of Arabs, a kindred racism and celebration of white supremacy. Israel will become synonymous with its victims, the way the Turks are synonymous with the Armenians, the Germans with the Namibians, and later the Jews, and the Serbs are with the Bosniaks. Israel's cultural, artistic, journalistic, and intellectual life will atrophy. Israel will be a stagnant nation where the religious fanatics, bigots, and Jewish extremists who have seized power will dominate public discourse. And it will join the club of the globe's most despotic regimes. Despotisms can exist long after their past due date, but they are terminal. Nations need more than force to survive. They need a mystique. This mystique provides purpose, civility, and even nobility to inspire citizens to sacrifice for the nation. The mystique offers hope for the future. It provides meaning. It provides national identity. And when mystiques implode, when they are exposed as lies, a central foundation of state power collapses. All Israel has left is escalating savagery, including torture and lethal violence against unarmed civilians. The Israeli military has carried out, according to the UN, since October 7th, 93 massacres in Gaza. This wholesale violence works in the short term as it did in the war waged by the French in Algeria, the dirty war in Argentina, the British occupation of India, Egypt, Kenya, and Northern Ireland, and the American occupations of Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan. But in the long term, they are all suicidal. The genocide in Gaza has turned Hamas resistance fighters into heroes in the global south. And Israel has killed hundreds of Palestinian leaders, including Yahya Sinwar. It assassinated Dr. Abdel Aziz al-Rantisi, one of the founders of Hamas, who I knew, and Khalil al-Wazir, known as Abu Jihad, who founded the PLO with Yasser Arafat, who I also knew. But the daily humiliation, forced impoverishment, indiscriminate violence, long prison terms, and torture is fertile training ground for resistance leaders. The long struggle for freedom by the Palestinians has made this point over and over and over. Run, the Israelis demand of the Palestinians in Gaza. Run for your lives. Run from Rafah, the way you ran from Gaza City, the way you ran from Jabalia, the way you ran from Deir al-Bala, the way you ran from Beit Hanun, the way you ran from Khan Yunis. Run, or we will kill you. We will drop GBU-39 bombs on your tent encampments and set them ablaze. We will spray you with bullets from our machine gun-equipped drones. We will pound you with artillery and tank shells. We will shoot you down with snipers. We will decimate your tents, your refugee camps, your cities and towns, your homes, your schools, your hospitals, and your water purification plants. We will rain death from the sky. Run for your lives again and again and again. Pack up the few belongings you have left, blankets, a couple of pots, some clothes. We don't care how exhausted you are, how hungry you are, how terrified you are, how sick you are, how old or how young you are. Run, run, run. And when you run in terror to one part of Gaza, we will make you turn around and run to another, trapped in a labyrinth of death, back and forth, up and down, side to side, 7, 8, 9, 10 times. We toy with you like mice in a trap. Then we deport you so you can never return, or we kill you. Let the world denounce our genocide. What do we care? The billions in military aid flows unchecked from our American ally. The fighter jets, the artillery shells, the tanks, the bombs, an endless supply. We kill children by the thousands. We kill women and the elderly by the thousands. The sick and injured without medicine and hospitals die. We poison the water. We cut off the food. We make you starve. We created this hell. We are the masters. Law, duty, a code of conduct, they do not exist for us. But first we toy with you. We humiliate you. We terrorize you. We revel in your fear. We are amused by your pathetic attempts to survive. You are not human. You are creatures, Untermensch. We feed our lust for domination. Look at our posts on social media. They have gone viral. One shows soldiers grinning in a Palestinian house with the owners tied up and blindfolded in the background. We loot rugs, cosmetics, motorbikes, jewelry, watches, cash, gold, antiquities. We mock your misery. We cheer your death. We celebrate our religion, our nation, our identity, our superiority by negating and erasing yours. Depravity is moral. Atrocity is heroism. Genocide is redemption. This is the game of terror played by Israel in Gaza. It was the game played during the dirty war in Argentina, which I covered as a reporter when the military junta disappeared 30,000 of its own citizens. The disappeared were subject to torture, and who cannot call what is happening to the Palestinians in Gaza torture, and humiliated before they were murdered. It was the game played in the clandestine torture centers and prisons I reported on in El Salvador and later Iraq. It is what I saw in the Serbian concentration camps in Bosnia. Israeli journalist Yanon Magal on the Ha Patria Team show on Israel's Channel 14 joked that Joe Biden's red line was the killing of 30,000 Palestinians. The singer Kobe Perez asked if this was the number of dead for a day. The audience erupted in applause and laughter. We know Israel's intent. Annihilate the Palestinians the same way the United States annihilated Native Americans. The Australians annihilated First Nations peoples. The Germans annihilated the Herero, the Turks, the Armenians, the Nazis, the Jews. The specifics are different, but the goal is the same, erasure, and we cannot plead ignorance. But of course, it is easier to pretend. Pretend Israel will allow humanitarian aid. Pretend there will be a permanent ceasefire. Pretend Palestinians will return to their destroyed homes in Gaza. Pretend Gaza will be rebuilt, the hospitals, the universities, the mosques, the housing. Pretend the Palestinian Authority will administer Gaza. Pretend there will be a two-state solution. Pretend there is no genocide. The vaunted democratic values, morality, and respect for human rights claimed by Israel and the United States has, of course, always been a lie. The real credo is this: we have everything. And if you try and take it away from us, we will kill you. People of color, especially when they are poor and vulnerable, do not count. The hopes, dreams, dignity, and aspirations for freedom of those outside the empire are worthless. Global domination will be sustained through racialized violence. The lie that the American empire is predicated on democracy and liberty is one the Palestinians and those in the global South, as well as Native Americans and Black and Brown Americans, not to mention those who live in the Middle East, have known for decades. But it is a lie that still has currency in the United States and Israel, a lie used to justify the unjustifiable. We do not halt Israel's genocide because we, as Americans, are Israel, infected with the same white supremacy and intoxicated by our domination of the globe's wealth and the power to obliterate others with our advanced weaponry. U.S. occupation forces in Iraq and Afghanistan, replicating, of course, what they did in Vietnam, deliberately maimed, abused, beat, tortured, raped, wounded, and killed hundreds of thousands of unarmed civilians, including children, and carried out, like Israel, targeted assassinations. After the Vietnam War, Nick Turse writes, most scholars wrote off the accounts of widespread war crimes that recur throughout Vietnamese revolutionary publications and American anti-war literature as merely so much propaganda. Few academic historians even thought to cite such sources, and almost none did so extensively. Meanwhile, My Lai came to stand for and thus blot out all other American atrocities. Vietnam War bookshelves are now filled with big picture histories, sober studies of diplomacy and military tactics, and combat memoirs told from the soldier's perspective. Buried and forgotten U.S. government archives, locked away in the memories of atrocity survivors, the real American war in Vietnam has all but vanished from public consciousness. Historical amnesia is a vital part of extermination campaigns once they end, at least for the victors. But for the victims, the memory of genocide, along with a yearning for retribution, is a sacred calling. The vanquished reappear in ways the genocidal killers cannot predict, fueling new conflicts and new animosities. The physical eradication of all Palestinians, the only way genocide ever works, is an impossibility. Given that 6 million Palestinians alone live in the diaspora, and over 5 million live in Gaza and the West Bank. Israel's genocide has enraged the 1.9 billion Muslims worldwide, as well as most of the global South. It has discredited and weakened the corrupt and fragile regimes of the dictatorships and monarchies in the Arab world, home to 456 million Muslims who collaborate with the US and Israel. And has fueled the ranks of the Palestinian resistance. What is happening in Gaza, of course, is not unprecedented. Indonesia's military, backed by the US, carried out a year-long campaign in 1965 to exterminate those accused of being communist leaders, functionaries, party members, and sympathizers. The bloodbath, most of it carried out by death squads and paramilitary groups, decimated the labor union movement along with the intellectual and artistic class, opposition parties, university student leaders, journalists, and ethnic Chinese. 1 million people were slaughtered. Many of the bodies were dumped into rivers, hastily buried, or left to rot on roadsides. And this campaign of mass murder is today mythologized in Indonesia, as it will be in Israel. It is portrayed as an epic battle against the forces of evil, just as Israel equates the Palestinians with Nazis. The killers in the Indonesia war against quote-unquote communism are cheered at political rallies, and they are lionized for saving the country. And we mythologize our genocide of Native Americans, romanticizing our killers, gunmen, outlaws, militias, and cavalry units. We, like Israel, fetishize our military. Industrial slaughter, what the sociologist James William Gibson calls techno-war, defines Israel's assault on Gaza and Lebanon. Techno-war is centered on the concept of overkill. Overkill, with its intentionally large numbers of civilian casualties, is justified as an effective form of deterrence. It is what Israel cynically calls mowing the lawn in Gaza. Incursion on October 7th by Hamas and other resistance groups, which left 1,154 Israelis, tourists, and migrant workers dead, and saw 240 people taken hostage, gave Israel the pretext for what it has long craved, the erasure of Palestinians. Israel has now damaged or destroyed all of Gaza's universities, nearly all of its educational facilities, and its 13 major libraries. It has destroyed at least 195 heritage sites, including 208 mosques, churches, and Gaza's central archives that held 150 years of historical records and documents. Israeli warplanes, missiles, tanks, drones, artillery shells, and naval guns pulverize Gaza as I speak, which is only 20 miles long and 5 miles wide, in a scorched earth campaign unlike anything seen since the war in Vietnam. It has dropped 25,000 tons of explosives, the equivalent of 2 nuclear bombs on Gaza, many of these targets selected by artificial intelligence. It drops unguided missiles, dumb bombs, and 2,000-pound bunker buster bombs on refugee camps and densely packed urban centers, as well as the so-called safe zones. 42% of Palestinians have been killed while sheltering in safe zones. Over 1.9 million Palestinians have been displaced from their homes, forced to find refuge in UNRWA shelters, hospital corridors and courtyards, schools, tents are in the open air, living next to fetid pools of raw sewage.
You are listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is To Kill a People, the opening keynote speech given by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Chris Hedges on November 1st, 2024 at the University of California at Santa Barbara.
The blockade of northern Gaza has left over 400,000 Palestinians enduring a starvation siege and constant airstrikes in an attempt to depopulate the north. Israeli forces have killed 1,250 Palestinians in this assault launched on October 5th. And reports from northern Gaza, of course, are difficult to obtain as internet and phone services have been cut and the few journalists on the ground have been denounced as Hamas members and targeted for murder. Civil defense units say they have been barred by Israeli forces from reaching most of the sites of the strikes, and their crews have been attacked. Israel has killed at least 42,000 Palestinians in Gaza, including 13,000 children and 9,000 women. It has wounded close to 100,000 others, many with life-crippling injuries. It has killed at least 136 journalists, many, if not most of them, deliberately targeted. It has killed 340 doctors, nurses, and other health workers, 4% of Gaza's healthcare personnel. 233 UNRWA workers have been killed in Gaza since October 7th. That's the highest death toll in UN history. And these numbers do not begin to reflect the actual death toll, since only those dead registered in morgues and hospitals, most of which no longer function, are counted. The death toll, when those who are missing are counted, is far, far above 40,000. At the same time, Gaza has been turned into a toxic wasteland. Nearly 40 million tons of debris, including unexploded ordnance and human remains, contaminate the ecosystem. More than 140 temporary waste sites and 340,000 tons of waste, untreated wastewater, and sewage overflow ensure the spread of diseases such as hepatitis A, respiratory infections, diarrhea, and skin diseases. And in a further blow, the Israeli parliament on Monday, last Monday, approved a bill to ban UNRWA, a lifeline for Palestinians in Gaza, from operating on Israeli territory and areas under Israel's control. This ban almost certainly ensures the collapse of aid distribution already crippled in Gaza. Israel has expanded its buffer zone along the Gaza perimeter to 16% of the territory, in the process leveling homes, apartment blocks, and farms. It has pushed over 84% of the 2.3 million people in Gaza into, the UN writes, a shrinking, unsafe humanitarian zone covering 12.6% of a territory now reconfigured in preparation for annexation. And satellite imagery indicates that the Israeli military has built roads and military bases in over 26% of Gaza, again, in the words of the UN, suggesting the aim of a permanent presence. Israel plays linguistic tricks to deny anyone in Gaza the status of civilians and any building, including mosques, hospitals, and schools, protected status. Palestinians are all branded as responsible for the attack on October 7th or written off as human shields for Hamas. All structures are considered legitimate targets by Israel because they are allegedly Hamas command centers or said to harbor Hamas fighters. These accusations Francesca Albanese, the UN Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories. Rights are a pretext used to justify the killing of civilians under a cloak of purported legality. In August, Albanese writes in her most recent report, entry permits for humanitarian organizations nearly halved. Access to water has been restricted to a quarter of pre-October 7th levels. Approximately 93% of the agricultural, forestry, and fishing economies have been destroyed. 95% of Palestinians face high levels of acute food insecurity and deprivation for decades to come. In recent months, 83% of food aid was prevented from entering Gaza, and the civilian police in Rafah were repeatedly targeted, shot, impairing distribution. At least 34 deaths from malnutrition were recorded by September of this year. These measures, she notes, indicate an intent to destroy its population through starvation. Of course, the occupation and genocide would not be sustained without the U.S., which gives Israel $3.8 billion a year in military assistance. The U.S. has spent $17.9 billion on military aid to Israel in the last 12 months, including providing massive 2,000-pound bombs and fighter jets. This, too, is our genocide. This genocide, of course, is the accumulation of a process. It's not an act. It is the predictable denouement of Israel's settler colonial project. It is coded within the DNA of the Israeli apartheid state. It is where Israel had to end up, and Zionist leaders are open about their goals. We do not halt Israel's genocide because we are Israel. If you remember the New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman telling Charlie Rose on the eve of the war in Iraq that American soldiers should go house to house from Basra to Baghdad and say to Iraqis, suck on this. And this, of course, is the real credo of the American empire. As climate change imperils survival, as resources become scarce, as migration becomes an imperative for millions, as agricultural yields decline, as coastal areas are flooded, as droughts and wild fires proliferate, as states fail, as armed resistance movements rise to battle their oppressors along with their proxies, genocide will not be an anomaly. It will be the norm. The earth's vulnerable and poor, those Frantz Fanon called the wretched of the earth, will be the next Palestinians. And the scorched earth tactics we see in Gaza and Lebanon are becoming common in the West Bank. Thousands of Palestinians in West Bank towns such as Jenin, Nablus, Qalqilia, and Tul Karam live for days under curfew, making it difficult to access food and water. As in Gaza, the Israeli army targets ambulances, blocks entrances to hospitals, and bulldozes streets and electricity and public health infrastructure. Drones and warplanes carry out airstrikes. Israeli roadblocks, checkpoints, and blockades make travel difficult or impossible. And Israel has suspended financial transfers to the Palestinian Authority, which nominally governs the West Bank, in collaboration with Israel. It has revoked 148,000 work permits for those who once had jobs in Israel. The gross domestic product of the West Bank has contracted by 22.7%. Nearly 30% of businesses have closed, and 292,000 jobs have been lost. Over 692 Palestinians, that's 10 times the previous 14 years' annual average of 69 fatalities, have been killed, and more than 5,000 have been injured. Of the 169 Palestinian children who have been killed in the West Bank, nearly 80% were shot in the head or the torso. Albanese's report dismisses the claim that Israel is carrying out the assault in Gaza and the West Bank to defend itself, eradicate Hamas, or bring the hostages home, charging that these claims are a camouflage, a way of invisibilizing the crime. Genocide, as Judge Dalveer Bhandari from the ICJ, International Court of Justice, points out, may exist simultaneously with other ulterior motives. Egypt and the other Arab states have refused to consider accepting Palestinian refugees. But Israel is banking on creating a humanitarian disaster of such catastrophic proportions that these countries or other countries will relent so they can depopulate Gaza and turn their attention to ethnically cleansing the West Bank. This is the plan, the intent, although no one, including Israel, knows if it will work. There is only one way to end the ongoing genocide in Gaza, and it is not through bilateral negotiations. Israel has amply demonstrated, including with the assassination of the lead Hamas negotiator, Ismail Haniyeh, that it has no interest in a permanent ceasefire. The only way for Israel's genocide of the Palestinians to be halted is for the U.S. to end all weapons shipments to Israel. And the only way this will take place is if enough Americans make clear that they have no intention of supporting any presidential ticket or any political party that fuels genocide. The arguments against a boycott of the two ruling parties are familiar. It will ensure the election of Trump. Harris has rhetorically shown more compassion. There are not enough of us to have an impact. We can work within the Democratic Party. The Israel lobby, or AIPAC, which owns most of Congress, is too powerful. Negotiations will eventually achieve a ceasefire. But in short, this says we are impotent and must surrender our agency to sustain a project of mass killing. We must accept as normal governance the shipment of billions of dollars in military aid to an apartheid state, the use of vetoes at the UN Security Council to protect Israel, and the active obstruction of international efforts to end mass murder. We have no choice. But genocide, the internationally recognized crime of crimes, is not a policy issue. It cannot be equated with trade deals, infrastructure bills, charter schools, or immigration. It is a moral issue. It is about the eradication of a people. And any surrender to genocide condemns us as a nation and as a species. It plunges the global society one step closer to barbarity. It eviscerates the rule of law. It mocks every fundamental value we claim to honor. It is in a category by itself. And to not, with every fiber of our being, combat genocide is to be complicit in what Hannah Arendt defines as radical evil, the evil where human beings, as human beings, are rendered superfluous. The fundamental lesson of the Holocaust, which writers such as Primo Levi stress, is that we can all become willing executioners. It takes very little. I saw this in every war I covered. We can all become complicit, if only through indifference and apathy. Monsters exist, Levy, who survived Auschwitz, writes, but they are too few in number to be truly dangerous. More dangerous are the common men and women, the functionaries, ready to believe and to act without asking questions. To confront evil, even if there is no chance of success, keeps alive our humanity and dignity. It allows us, as Václav Havel writes, to live in truth. A truth the powerful do not want spoken and seek to suppress. It provides a guiding light to those who come after us. It tells the victims they are not alone. It is humanity's revolt against an enforced position, and an attempt to regain control over one's sense of responsibility. What does it say about us if we accept a world where we arm and fund a nation that kills and wounds hundreds of innocent people a day? What does it say about us if we support an orchestrated famine and the poisoning of the water supply where the polio virus has been detected, meaning tens of thousands of people will get sick and many will die? What does it say about us if we permit, for over 12 months, the bombing of refugee camps, hospitals, villages, and cities to wipe out families and force survivors to camp out in the open or find shelter in crude tents? What does it say about us when we accept the murder of over 11,000 children, although this is surely an undercount? What does it say about us when we watch Israel escalate attacks on UN facilities, schools, including the Al-Ta'abain School in Gaza City, where over 100 Palestinians were killed while performing the Fajr, or dawn prayers, and other emergency shelters? What does it say about us when we permit Israel to use Palestinians as human shields by forcing handcuffed civilians, including children and the elderly, to enter potentially booby-trapped tunnels and buildings in advance of Israeli troops, at times dressed in Israeli military uniforms? What does it say about us when we support politicians and soldiers who defend the rape and torture of prisoners? Are these the kinds of allies we want to empower? Is this behavior we want to embrace? What message does this send to the rest of the world? If we do not hold fast to moral imperatives, we are doomed. Evil will triumph. It means there is no right and wrong. It means anything, including mass murder, is permissible. Hope lies with those who resist. The university, it lies in the university encampments, in the occupation of buildings, in the hunger strikes, in the streets, and of course, in third parties that defy empire. These people who march to the beat of a different drummer are the nation's conscience. A moral stance always has a cost. If there is no cost, it is not moral, it is merely conventional belief. But what price of peace, the radical Catholic priest Daniel Berrigan, who was sent to federal prison for burning draft records during the war in Vietnam, asks. I think of all the good, decent, peace-loving people I have known by the thousands, and I wonder, how many of them are so afflicted by the wasting disease of normalcy that even as they declare for peace, their hands reach out with an instinctive spasm in the direction of their comforts, their home, their security, their income, their future, their plans, that 5-year plan of studies, that 10-year plan of professional status, that 20-year plan of family growth and unity, that 50-year plan of decent life and honorable natural demise. Of course, let us have peace, we cry. But at the same time, let us have normalcy. Let us lose nothing. Let our lives stand intact. Let us know neither prison nor ill repute nor disruption of ties. And because we must encompass this and protect that, and because at all costs, our hopes must march on schedule, and because it is unheard of that in the name of peace a sword should fall, disjoining that fine and cunning web that our lives have woven, because it is unheard of that good men should suffer injustice or families be sundered or good repute be lost, because of this, we cry peace. And cry peace, and there is no peace. There is no peace because there are no peacemakers. There are no makers of peace because the making of peace is at least as costly as the making of war, at least as exigent, at least as disruptive, at least as liable to bring disgrace and prison and death in its wake. The question is not whether resistance is practical. It is whether resistance is right. We are enjoined to love our neighbor, not our tribe. We must have faith that the good draws to it the good, even if the empirical evidence around us is bleak. And the good is always embodied in action. It must be seen. It does not matter if the wider society is censorious. We are called to defy, through acts of civil disobedience and noncompliance, the laws of the state when these laws, as they often do, conflict with moral law. We must stand, no matter the cost, with the crucified of the earth. If we fail to take this stand, whether against the abuses of militarized police, the inhumanity of our vast prison system, or the genocide in Gaza, we become the crucifiers. Mockery of every sort was added to their deaths. The Roman historian Tacitus wrote of those the Emperor Nero singled out for torture and death. Covered with the skins of beasts, they were torn by dogs and perished, or were nailed to crosses, or were doomed to the flames and burnt to serve as a nightly illumination when daylight had expired. Sadism by the powerful is the curse of the human condition. It was as prevalent in ancient Rome as it is in Israel. We know the modern face of Nero, who illuminated his opulent garden parties by burning to death captives tied to stakes. That is not in dispute. But who were Nero's guests? Who wandered through the emperor's grounds as human beings, as in Rafa, were burned alive? How could these guests see, and no doubt hear, such horrendous suffering and witness such appalling torture and be indifferent, even content? Who were Nero's guests? We are Nero's guests, and history will judge Israel for this genocide, but it will also judge us. It will ask why we did not do more, why we did not sever all agreements, all trade deals, all accords, all cooperation with a genocidal state, why we did not halt weapon shipments to Israel, why we did not recall our ambassadors, why, when the maritime trade in the Red Sea was disrupted by Yemen, an alternative overland route into Israel was set up by Saudi Arabia and Jordan, why we did not do everything in our power to end the slaughter. And history will condemn us for not heeding the fundamental lesson of the Holocaust, which is not that Jews are eternal victims, but that when you have the capacity to stop genocide and you do not, you are culpable. The opposite of good is not evil, Samuel Johnson wrote. The opposite of good is indifference. The Palestinian resistance is our resistance. The Palestinian struggle for dignity, freedom, and independence is our struggle. The Palestinian cause is our cause. For as history has also shown, those who were once Nero's guests soon become Nero's victims. Thank you.
You've been listening to Essential Dissent. This episode was To Kill a People, the opening keynote speech given by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Chris Hedges on November 1st, 2024 at the University of California at Santa Barbara. Chris Hedges can be found on Substack and on the Chris Hedges YouTube channel. We'll end with two short pieces written by Caitlin Johnstone and read by Tim Foley. The first is titled, That Which Can Be Destroyed by the Truth Should Be, and the second is Let Yourself Be Shattered by Gaza. Thanks for listening, and remember, never believe anything until you hear the official denial.
That which can be destroyed by the truth should be. This is a line by fantasy author P.C. Hodgell, though it's often misattributed to Carl Sagan. I think about this quote a lot. I think about it when reflecting on the way Israel is exterminating Palestinian journalists in Gaza while keeping Western journalists out of the enclave to prevent the world from learning the truth about what the IDF is doing there. I think about it when reflecting on the mountains of government secrecy with which the Western Empire protects its information interests, imprisoning whistleblowers and persecuting journalists who try to expose the truth about its criminal actions around the world. I think about it when reflecting on the nonstop deluge of empire propaganda that public consciousness is hammered with to manipulate the masses into accepting the global leadership of the U.S. centralized power structure. I think about it when reflecting on the U.S. war machine and how all the military operations of Washington and its allies are always justified by lies. I think about it when reflecting on dysfunctional relationships that are held in place by secrets and dishonesty, preventing the ones being deceived from freeing themselves and finding their way into a life of authenticity. I think about it when reflecting on the ego and how easily its illusory nature can be seen with a penetrating insight into the truth of how human perception and cognition are really operating. There are times when withholding the truth would be in the highest interest. Someone lying to the police to protect someone from unjust persecution at the hands of an unjust system. A journalist protecting a source by obfuscating the truth from government agents. A battered wife lying to her husband to calm him down. An abused child lying to their abuser about what they've been doing. But as near as I can tell, the only times when withholding the truth is in the highest interest is when there's an abusive power dynamic at play, and the person in the down power position is using untruth to protect someone in an unjust situation which should not exist in the first place. In all other instances, truth is best. Truth is the great equalizer. It makes the abuses of the powerful much more difficult to execute, and gives the disempowered much more power. This is why our rulers are constantly working to expand surveillance and eliminate the privacy of ordinary citizens while increasing government secrecy to allow themselves to hide the truth, when in a healthy society, it would be the exact opposite. In a healthy society, ordinary members of the public would have enshrined privacy protections against the government, and any governmental systems would be as transparent as air. In a healthy society, there would be a direct one-to-one correlation between power and transparency. The more power you have, the more transparency should be required of you, and the less power you have, the more secrecy you should be shielded with. This would protect ordinary citizens from abuse at the hands of the powerful, and prevent the powerful from becoming abusive toward the citizenry. We know this is true because all the most abusive power structures work constantly to reverse this dynamic to the furthest extent possible. A healthy society will be a truth-based society. It's hard to imagine what a society that is guided by truth would look like because we live in a society that is made of lies. If deceit magically became impossible today, all our institutions would crumble by tomorrow. A truth-based society would mean the total destruction of all that is familiar to us right now. But that which can be destroyed by the truth should be. Truth can be scary because in any situation sustained by falsehood, truth is a destructive force. It can cause political upheaval. It can end relationships. It can annihilate egoic delusion. Any of these will typically feel like a giant leap into the unknown and are generally terrifying for that exact reason. But this is the only path toward health. If we are to survive on this planet, eventually we are going to have to take that leap. Eventually we're going to have to become a truth-driven species. Everything about our current status quo will resist this movement. The untruth in our current power structures, and the untruth within ourselves. Maybe we won't take that leap until things get so bad that the unknown looks less terrifying than what the familiar has become. Maybe we will find our courage before it comes to that point. But we're going to have to jump for it eventually, or we will go the way of the dinosaur. And if it does come to that, If we are collectively unable to take the leap because we value our lies more than our lives, that too will reveal a truth to us about who we are and what we were always made of. One way or the other, truth will have the final say. That which can be destroyed by the truth should be, and eventually will be. Let yourself be shattered by Gaza. In the suburbs, they live with animals in their homes, who they treat like people and love like children, while ignoring real children in Gaza. They'll take a baby dog away from its mother and hack its ancient canine conditioning to mistake a Western nuclear family for its wolf pack in order to fill the void in their hearts which yearns for unconditional love, all while hoarding their own love so far deep in their chest caves that they cannot feel anything for a Palestinian burn victim in a bombed-out hospital who is screaming because there's no painkiller. We have so far isolated ourselves from nature that we need to fill our homes with potted plants and docile domesticated animals just to feel whole. We drink our wine and chuckle at memes and talk to our dogs like we talk to babies, while the world turns to fire and feral dogs feast on corpses in Gaza. These last 14 months have shattered me. Shattered me beyond the power of recollection. But sometimes it's good to be shattered. Sometimes it's good to be dashed to the floor and cracked wide open so that life can get a word in. Sometimes the heart must be broken to smash through the calluses and cataracts which accumulate on its surface and return us to our original tenderness. This world will break your heart and then pour plant medicine into the cracks. It will show you a dead Palestinian child, and then show you a white kite in the sky. It will drop you to your knees, screaming in anguish, cursing a God you don't even believe in, bawling your eyes out, only to open them and stare in wonder at a dandelion growing through the cracks in the concrete. It will annihilate everything you believed about humanity in a blazing holocaust, and then leave you blinking and bewildered in a mysterious universe of unfathomable beauty, the rusted chains of perception incinerated from your eyes. Again and again and again, we are shattered to dust and scattered to the wind by the cruelty of this world, slowly learning that, if we can fully surrender to the shattering, it will return us to that primordial clarity we abandoned long ago when we set out to create this mess in the first place. Let yourself be shattered by heartbreak, by loss, and by Gaza. Let your whole universe be reduced to ashes. Let it all die away, and then stand up and rejoin the fight, eyes no longer clouded by anything that could be destroyed by truth.